Welcome to Trade Talk Africa, a Pan-African podcast about trade, trends, and investment opportunities. In this episode, we continue our series to understand the African trade finance landscape. We're speaking with John Martin Ndaula, Associate Vice President at Africa Finance Corporation in Nigeria. The Africa Finance Corporation is fast-tracking Africa's economic development with investments in over 35 African countries. John, you're welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Amanda. It's a pleasure.
Let's get into it. And we'd like to understand, what are some of the key achievements of trade finance on the African continent over the past 20 years? Anything notable to highlight?
Yes. I think the achievements that I would speak about are not just the achievements of trade finance, but the achievements of the African continent generally. I would speak about the growth and strengthening of regional cooperation and economic integration. I think that has been a key achievement from which trade finance in Africa has benefited. So the regional economic communities have made significant progress in promoting trade and also customs and currency unions. And indeed, if you go back to the history of the African continent of free trade area, which was the Lagos Plan of Action in 1980, the strategy then was to begin by setting up these regional economic bodies to follow a bottom-to-up approach, and then that would lead to the African continent of free trade area where we are. So I think, the regional economic bodies have been a success. I think the efforts that we've seen recently around the development of infrastructure on the continent have also yielded some fruit. We cannot say that it's anywhere near enough, but the activities, especially with the increase of Chinese activity on the continent, has been helpful. They've helped to develop critical infrastructure in the form of highways, in the form of bridges, in the form of rail, which are important for trade finance in Africa. Also, the developments in IT have, in IT and technology generally, have helped to reduce information asymmetry between borrowers and lenders. And this has also helped to grow trade financing in Africa, because really one of the things that hinders the growth of trade finance is the lack of information or the information gap between borrowers and lenders. So we've been able to harness technology to reduce this gap, and this has helped to lead to the growth of trade finance.
Interesting. Still on that line of thought, trade can be an important catalyst for economic growth. However, Africa as a continent has yet to fully capture the growth-enhancing benefits of trade. Today, the continent's shares of global GDP and trade stand at only 3%. And we've talked about this on literally every episode of this podcast. And yet, Africa accounts for over 11% of the world's population. How has trade finance evolved over the years to strengthen trade, poverty reduction, and inclusion?
Yeah, so historically, financing generally in Africa has been, the traditional kind: go to the bank, get a loan, or better still, get an overdraft and go do your business, right? But with the increase of skills, with the increase of knowledge, I think financing around trade has improved. I think this has also been driven by, new developments in the regulatory landscape. Banks that used to give overdrafts now insist on tying, the financing to the purpose for which the financing is being used for, and putting a structure around that, essentially a working capital trade finance structure, to ensure that the banks meet regulatory requirements and also conserve their capital. So the adoption of such new methods of working capital, such as invoice discounting and supply chain finance, they've increased the access to trade finance. But as we know, this is not nearly enough, with the trade finance gap in Africa standing at about $90 billion. Better still, even the use of technology and the proliferation of trade finance fintechs is helping to increase access to trade finance. In Kenya, for example, we have seen that farmers are able to upload invoice information into their phones, and they're able to obtain financing from a lender nearly instantly, again through the same phone, through the mobile money. And we can see that, you know, that has helped bring more people into the financing environment.
Interesting. You touched also on the Continental Free Trade Area earlier on, and we are all aware that this was launched at the beginning of 2021. How can the financial system and the banking industry better innovate and adapt to support Africans to capitalize on regional trade?
Yeah, so as I stated initially, you know, the precursor to the African Continental Free Trade Agreement was the regional economic communities. And this strategy was built in 1980 during the Lagos Plan of Action, a meeting which was put together by the African Union then. Now, the regional economic communities that we talk about are actually 8 in number. They include the ones that we know, you know, East African Community, ECOWAS, SADC, et cetera, et cetera. Historically, as I said, it was a bottom-up approach, but now there's actually a need for a top-down approach, which means, you know, coherence and coordination between countries so as to achieve the objectives of the Continental Free Trade Area. So therefore, the discussion now becomes about policy coordination and standardization. See, so specifically to the banking industry in Africa, there has been steps to create frameworks that would facilitate such coordination and standardization, and therefore help to bring to fruition some of the objectives of the Continental Free Trade Area. I'll give an example. For instance, there are two initiatives which are being led by Afrexim Bank. The first one is the what's called the Pan-African Payment Settlement System. And the objective of this system is really to enable intra-African trade by enabling, you know, the players, the commercial players in the different countries to make payments in their local currencies. So if you have a person in Nigeria importing wine from South Africa, they would be able to pay for that wine in Naira. Or if you have a person from South Africa importing, for argument's sake, copper from Zambia, they would be able to pay for that copper in South African rand, et cetera, et cetera. So that really does a lot to eliminate a lot of frictions or a lot of hindrances to what would be the intra-African trade, in that, you know, the costs around, you know, FX and even the risks around FX fluctuation are all eliminated. Now, the other initiative is around another system called MANSA. MANSA is a Pan-African Customer Due Diligence System for use and the benefit by financial institutions, by corporate entities, and also SMEs. So the objective of MANSA is really to provide a compliance solution for Africa that also meets global standards. As you know very well, compliance is really a hot topic in finance, not just in Africa, but globally. And as part of creating financing frameworks for intra-African trade, it is one of the boxes that really must be ticked and must be ticked well, because you know, you don't want to get in trouble with the powers that be by financing flows which are considered to be illicit or considered to be related to terrorism, because obviously whatever you're trying to do will be shut down. So if we tick these two boxes, then we believe that we are really on the right track towards achieving the objectives of the African Continental Free Trade Area.
Brilliant. You've given me a homework to look into that African payment system, because one of the things we've talked about again is putting people to task and say, how can we facilitate payments in real time while preserving value? The other thing we've touched on also is SMEs and their role in job creation and in overall growth. We state here that SMEs account for 90% of businesses and they employ a significant portion of people, especially young people. However, 28% of banks' total trade finance portfolio only goes to SMEs, while the bulk of trade facilities serve larger companies. How can the access to trade finance solution be broadened to increase SMEs? And what shifts do we need to be working towards in the future?
Yeah, so if you say that 28% of banks' total trade finance portfolios benefit SMEs, that's equivalent to just about a third of banks' portfolios being to SMEs. And as we already know, you know, they make up the majority of trade finance players, these SMEs. So the question would really be, the question that we have to ask is, why do banks shun them? Why are they only a third and not more? See, now the answer to this question is, I would say, pretty straightforward. The answer is that they are perceived to be riskier, and indeed they are riskier. According to the African Development Bank, the default rates for trade finance in Africa is generally at about 5%. However, if you zero in on the SMEs, their default rate is almost three times that level, at about 14%, which is very high. You can't make loans and have 14% of those loans defaulting in banking. That would be a very high number. So I think that really gives the reason why they form just about 28% of banks' portfolios. So in order for SMEs to obtain greater access to financing, the objective should really be to de-risk SMEs and to increase their credit worthiness. So this is it would take a multidimensional effort, I think, not just the SMEs themselves and not just the banks themselves, but there would be a number of players that would come together to make this happen. And of course, we believe that this also benefits everyone. It benefits entire economies. So that effort, the multidimensional effort which I've spoken about, would, for instance, first and foremost involve governments. Governments are the policymakers. They should ensure that the regulation and reporting requirements are robust, and they should also implement solutions which reduce the risk of borrowers, for instance, like reducing information asymmetry. I spoke about information asymmetry earlier as being the difference between what a bank knows and what the borrower knows, you know, such that the bank might lose money. So one of the things that I've seen governments do, which has been brilliant, has been the introduction of credit reference bureau, for instance. You know, we have one in Uganda. I think Ghana also has one. This credit reference bureau, they create a database of the credit history of industry players, such that, you know, one is able to build a credit profile which a new lender or a new borrower to a lender can benefit from if they go to apply for credit. You know, you don't have to, if you have a good credit profile, you might not have to submit the level of, for instance, collateral, or be subjected to a high level of interest because you're being considered risky, you know, and therefore that serves to benefit you. Another player that needs to take part is the banks, who need to innovate new lending structures, which are inclusive, which will bring more of these players into the financing space. Such structures include supply chain financing and factoring. As we know, these structures enable banks to provide financing to SMEs on the back of the bank's dealings with bigger players, with bigger corporate players. So such banks would help to certainly bring more SMEs into the financing space. Development banks and development partners also have a critical role to play. They provide de-risking in the form of providing payment risk cover, you know, in the form of guarantees and insurance. And not only that, they also provide technical assistance. So development banks will actually, you know, develop programs that might go to teach SMEs, you know, how they can be better candidates for financing. Because some of these people really don't know. They don't know about bookkeeping. They don't know about corporate governance. You know, the development partners might work with governments to put in place educational programs that might benefit SMEs with regards to the management of their businesses and how to make them better candidates for credit. And then lastly, the SMEs themselves, they need to know and they need to appreciate, first of all, that, you know, If you go to borrow money, the money has to be paid back, both principal and interest, because banks see the money that they lend out as liabilities. Liabilities means it's a claim. So if at the end of the day they are not able to get it back, you know, they are also left hanging. So I think the SMEs have to appreciate that, and they have to work on themselves as well. They have to improve their corporate governance. They have to improve their record keeping. They have to improve their compliance. They have to pay attention to environmental and social governance and sustainability issues, etc., etc. So at the end of the day, if we have this collaborative effort between all these players, I think we shall be able to attain a greater proportion of SMEs as part of the finance portfolios of traditional lenders.
That's very exhaustive. I wouldn't have much to add to that. I think it makes sense now to move on to the pandemic, which of course has also affected SMEs. But broadly speaking, the COVID-19 pandemic led to broken supply chains, we're all aware of that, and challenges in the trade world, of which trade finance is a major driver. What were the effects of the pandemic on clients' performance and the overall trade finance history, the overall trade finance industry, I beg your pardon, in the year 2020?
Yeah, so initially, as we saw, and especially in the first half of 2020, the COVID pandemic did really cripple supply chains, and it because it hindered the physical movement of goods. You know, we saw not just inland, but also on the high seas, container ships being stuck, you know, governments not being sure how to treat their borders, you know, especially to cargo. So we saw such supply bottlenecks affecting global merchandise trade in the first half of 2020. Trade fell. However, according to WTO, this trend was actually reversed in the second half of 2020 and supply chains started to recover. So the WTO actually reported in their first half of 2021 report that global trade, which had fallen by about 5% in 2020, was actually expected to grow by about 8% in 2021. So I think that's testament to the fact that even though there was an initial dip, there was also a quick recovery. Now, we know that there were sectors which were not significantly impacted by COVID, but there were also others which were very severely and negatively impacted. Industries such as air transport and tourism and recreation and entertainment and hotels and hospitality were severely impacted by the pandemic, brought to their knees. And then the others such as, you know, real estate and manufacturing and health saw relatively little impact. In fact, some of them probably even thrived. So from the financing angle, you know, as is always the case during downturns and periods of economic uncertainty, there's always heightened alertness among financiers, you know, when we see such uncertainty. And like we saw in the, for instance, during the global financial crisis, this alertness also translates into retrenchment. So they essentially pull back. You know, you take a wait and see approach. If you had availed credit lines, you call back those credit lines, call back loans. That is the initial reaction of financiers. So we saw this in the first half of 2020, as many banks either cut back or tended to, you know, take a wait and see approach, especially to the sectors which I just mentioned above. However, I think we were happy to see that governments and also multilateral agencies were quick to intervene. They provided support and assurance, and this assurance, you know, it helped to restore some of the confidence into the markets and into economies. We have seen across the board, for instance, in Africa, how central banks and governments have been key in supporting banking sectors to manage their liquidity and also their asset quality, their NPL levels. So governments have provided direct emergency funding, for instance, that has been channeled into key sectors in their economies. For instance, in a country like Egypt, whose economy thrives on tourism, we had the central bank come in quickly to announce packages, relief packages to hotels and to, you know, other tourism industry players, which kind of helped to mitigate the effects of the pandemic in that geography. Similarly, we've seen international organizations like the World Bank and the IMF that have come in to provide loans and specifically for the IMF balance of payment support, which has helped to keep, you know, local currencies stable. I think without such support, we'd have seen terrible happenings in the currency landscape in Africa. But if you look at the currency landscape over the past 1 year, I was actually looking at that this morning, you know, yes, there are countries whose currencies have devalued significantly, like South Sudan and Zimbabwe, but these are, and Angola as well, these are the countries that kind of had historical problems before the pandemic. For most of the countries, you know, the devaluations have not been that significant. They have been within a relatively narrow range. And for some of the countries, you know, like Uganda, for instance, that have an agricultural economy that are not dependent on commodities, we've actually seen the currency somewhat gain some strength. So I think that was a positive. Multilateral banks have also come in with specific COVID relief in the form of support facilities to sovereigns, to banks, and also to SMEs. So I think that was also good to mitigate the effects of the pandemic. So because of all of those factors combined, we have seen a recovery in the availability of finance around the continent. I think the people that had begun the last year by being apprehensive have now come back into the market. And you see that in the form of yields on sovereign bonds, for instance. If you look at the yields on sovereign bonds, many of them went up at around quarter two last year, but they've come back down and stabilized. So that shows you that investors have some confidence and that they are back. So in fact, right now we might be dealing with a lack of origination on the part of the users of finance. Amanda, you probably have seen a story in the Ugandan press recently that the banking sector liabilities are at an all-time high, right? So it is likely that borrowers are not yet confident about borrowing again, you know, probably as a result of the lockdowns that we have seen recently. But I think lenders are somewhat ready to lend.
Interesting. When we speak to lenders, they say they want to lend. When we speak to borrowers, they say they can't find the money. It's one of those where the answer always changes depending on whom you ask. But let's move on to another challenge of our time, and that is climate change. It's fast become a major challenge with worries of lowered output, increasing unemployment, and of course, risks on food security. Actions against climate change are being rallied in the finance world with a drive of sustainable investment through climate finance actions. What direct role can trade finance play in the fight against climate change?
Yeah, so similar to other asset classes, I think it's critical that banks, as part of their trade finance lending activities, ensure that environmental and social governance objectives are met even while lending to trade finance. However, you know, you can acknowledge that for trade finance as an asset class, this emphasis on ESG and sustainability has not historically been present. You know, if you look, for instance, at the Equator Principles of the IFC, you know, they really focus more on, you know, project finance type transactions and even some capital markets activities. So if a client wants to issue a bond, for instance, or take out a loan, there are already standards, as I mentioned, like the Equator Principles, that are well recognized that would introduce the ESG and sustainability elements into those structures. However, for trade finance structures, these standards they are not yet in place. According to the research I did, there's actually currently a working group of global banks that are building the concept of that they've called green trade finance, in which they are working to form a framework and eligibility criteria for green trade finance transactions. So I think that is a plus. They're essentially acknowledging that, you know, Trade finance does not have to be an asset class that is excluded from sustainability and the ESG discussion, but rather it should also be included. And this is very important, I think. I'll give an example. You will acknowledge that agriculture is the largest user of land resources globally, right? And there's a significant link between agriculture and agricultural commodities and trade finance. And therefore, such green trade finance standards which have been envisaged would play a critical role in ensuring the adoption of sustainability principles in agriculture, and hence a significant boost to the green and the climate anti-climate change drive. So I think that trade finance should certainly be included as one of the points or as one of the areas through which ESG should be monitored actively.
You touched on asset classes, and when I speak to people in the finance world, they say trade finance has proven to be a low-risk asset class because it's short-term and transactional in nature and majorly dominated by commercial banks. However, with increasing demand, a current global financing gap of, they say, $1.5 trillion and new regulations, trade finance investment opportunities are opening now to non-banking investors. And we've seen a lot of non-bank actors aggressively expanding into Africa. How can investors on the African continent tap into this opportunity, and what could be the benefits to them?
Yeah, Amanda, thank you for this question. I think it's a very good question. It's a very important question. Because the introduction of non-bank investors in the landscape, in the trade finance landscape, it's critical because it is meant to increase the availability of trade finance liquidity and therefore help to close the trade finance gap. You know, we keep saying that the trade finance gap is growing. I think one of the ways that gap might be dealt with is through allowing non-bank investors, or through putting in place means for non-bank investors to be able to bring in new money towards trade finance activities. Now, according to the African Development Bank, the proportion of African trade financed by banks is only about 28%. I think we already discussed that. So this implies that there's already a significant opportunity for non-bank players, right? Now, the relevance of non-bank players, it's been increased by developments and trends in the industry. Because with the changing regulatory landscape, it was necessary for banks to closely manage their capital allocations in line with the new requirements. You know, we talk about Basel II and Basel III. Banks basically had to go back to the drawing board to see, okay, which areas of our balance sheets are actually risky? Where do we need to retrench from? Where do we need to focus? Now, because of that recalibration, emerging markets, and specifically, you know, Africa, we ended up suffering. So sometime at the beginning of this decade, you know, we had global banks really reducing their appetite for Africa because they considered it to be riskier. As a result, you know, opportunities for non-bank players basically present themselves as the other players tend to leave the continent. Now, given that background, we've seen some entrepreneurial individuals, you know, with the necessary skills that have come up to form what are called trade finance funds. Now, trade finance funds, they are non-bank intermediaries in the trade finance space that pull money from investors, and then they deploy that liquidity for the benefit of this discussion, exclusively trade finance assets. In Uganda, for instance, we have investment clubs. So I like to think of these trade finance funds as some sort of sophisticated investment club. You see, the investors in such funds would not suffer from a lack of demand because, as we've highlighted, there's already need. You know, only a third of banks' portfolios are to trade funds, for instance. So there's already need. So if investors come in the form of trade finance funds, they would find ready demand for their liquidity that they are providing, and this would also mean that the returns that they would generate from their activities would be attractive. But a key ingredient, in my view, is that for the invest is that you know, for this to make sense to the investors, they would have to put, you know, focus on areas like risk management, because obviously, you know, trade finance requires skills. And if you're in none, what banks have really is that they have the skills to offer these kinds of solutions. And if you're a non-bank investor, or if you're a non-bank investment manager, and you're going to get people's money and put it into these assets, you really have to have the skills to do this, so that you don't lose people's money and then end up creating a loss of confidence and a loss of trust, which will have the opposite effect in terms of attracting new money into the trade finance space. A new concept that I've also come across is the use of securitization in agricultural value chains, particularly agricultural receivables financing. So you probably have heard of securitization. It was a common buzzword during the global financial crisis, where banks would make mortgages to what were called subprime borrowers. And then as they were earning interest repayment flows from those mortgages, they would then package the mortgages, put them into the form of securities that they would then offer to investors. So essentially they would sell to investors, you know, regular cash flows from established mortgages. They would get new money, and then they would use that money to form new mortgages, and that cycle would repeat itself. So essentially, this securitization is a kind of structure that enables a lender, or it doesn't have to be a bank. It could be, you know, some form of a special purpose vehicle. I think that's what they are called. So this could also be used in the African trade finance landscape. I can give a quick example, right? So, for instance, to increase financing to say the livestock sector, you see, a farmers association might set up a company, So I call it an SPV, and this company would take ownership, say, of a bunch of cattle somewhere. Now, the company would issue securities. It could be in the form of notes, or it could be in the form of bonds, and then those securities would be sold to investors over an exchange. Now, investors would then earn regular payments similar to the coupons of a bond, which payments would come from the milk or the beef that's being produced by the cows. And then at the end of the day, you know, the Farmers Association gets financing from investors, while the investors get a steady flow of income. So it's a sort of innovative way to attract new capital to some of these areas that are underfinanced. However, for this particular type of structure, there are still quite a number of key ingredients that I don't think we have in many African countries. For instance, like a developed level of capital markets that would enable this kind of securitization to take place, because I think it's a product that has to be managed over a securities exchange, many of which we don't have in African countries. So I think those are just some of the examples through which investors might be able to tap into opportunities in the trade finance space.
With all of these major lessons picked up over the years and the innovations in finance that you've talked about, what do you see as the outlook of trade finance going forward? How can providers adapt and innovate to better serve clients in the coming years, given also that Africa is going to be looking more and more to sell to fellow African countries?
Yeah, I think at the beginning I spoke about, what is a key theme in financial circles now, which is digitization and fintech. We've seen fintech companies coming up, and they've proven their ability to use emerging technologies to solve some of the problems that established banks couldn't solve before. And it is also for this reason, for instance, that you've seen banks that have taken up to snapping up fintech companies. There had been an increased level of M&A within the financial space for fintech companies, with banks, you know, adopting fintechs as part of their operations. I think the example that I can give again here is in the supply chain finance and factoring space, where, as I indicated when I spoke about the Kenya example, you know, the fintechs, they've used technology to not only scale up this product, the supply chain finance, but they've also used technology to lower the risk. And this is essentially what traditional lenders are looking for. You see, we're looking for scale because scale helps to lower unit costs. And we're also looking for lower risk. As long as we can get those two, then we'll be able to provide financing. So I believe that, you know, in the future, and as competition among lenders increases, we will see more of some of these underserved sectors, you know, receiving attention. But this will be because of new innovations like what the fintechs are doing that will enable, you know, the key players that will be ahead of the pack to go ahead and foray into those new areas.
John, I have to say thank you so much. It's been a pleasure understanding from you all of your insights on trade finance across Africa. Thank you so much for your perspectives in different sectors and opportunities. And we look forward to engaging with you further down the line. Thank you.
Thank you very much.